The great strategy of bioregionalism was that we re-inhabit where we are.
Yes.
How does that look to you in this neighborhood, for example? And what are the rituals of re-inhabitation? Paint us a picture of what this really looks like when we re-inhabit the place.
Yes. You know, the word re-inhabitation gets some people into trouble. So I'll just say one caveat about it first. Indigenous people sometimes hear that and they go, oh man, this is a second round of domination. And if the word suggests that, we need other words to make sure that that is not what we're saying. It's not a second regime of habitation. As a matter of fact, re-inhabitation first and foremost begins with a thorough honesty and investigation of the historical record and present reality of habitation. Whose lives were displaced? Upon whose backs was this built? Human and non-human. What were the ecosystems in play that are now scarcely imaginable? This summer when I was working on a different project, I reread Muir's 1,000-mile walk to the Gulf of Mexico. When he gets to Florida, his description of Florida reminds me of no place I've ever seen in Florida. And he claims it was true of the whole state, just about. It's an amazing thing that this book, you know, was written in the, you know, 1867, I guess, was the walk. The book didn't come out until right after Muir died. But it's unimaginable, the world that Muir walked in. So inhabitation is also a deep imagination of what this place was. And that includes its peoples, and by peoples I mean human and non-human. It's a deep reckoning with ourselves and our culture. That being said, it's also the following. Part of habitation is you're not in it for the long haul. You know, that where you live is just the raw resources that drew you here. Use them up, and if they run out, if you sully the place, if you kill off all the things that make it possible to sustain life, you move on. So it's a form of living in which space is for us to use, and for us, therefore, if we so desire, to use up.
Disposable.
Disposable space.
Right.
It's because, you know, as we say, this was said of both land and slaves in this culture, it is at our disposal.
So,
human beings that can be used, you know, at our disposal. That's why it was in the state of in the Constitution of Carolina when John Locke, the great philosopher, added on it. It was not possible to murder a slave because a slave belonging to you could be used at your disposal. So, re-inhabitation, the land is not at our disposal, neither its peoples nor its enabling conditions. So imagine you're going to be here for 1,000 years. Even if you're here for one day, imagine you're going to be here for 1,000 years and begin to undo the practices of disposability.
That's a tough sell on Airbnb. Come here for 1,000 years.
Yes, but even if you come for a day, you know, that we live at the earth's pleasure.
Right.
That's to turn upside down. The earth is here, and we'll use it at our pleasure.
So when I think of re-inhabitation, I am heartened by the fact that there's the one farm in the city of Seattle is Rainier Beach.
In, right down here.
Right down by Pritchard Island.
And in one of the poorest parts of the city.
Right.
And we're going to say, okay, those who experience city living really as a form of nature deprivation, we'll start here. We're going to teach you to work the land. It's a magnificent what they're doing down there. Rainier Beach is one of the best places to live on the west coast of Turtle Island, in my opinion.
What are some of the other examples of what re-inhabitation might look like in practice, in daily practice?
In this neighborhood, struggling with gentrification, deeply, deeply understanding how the ecology of this neighborhood is interrelated with the ecology of the city, with the ecology of the region.
Daylighting Mapes Creek, for example.
Daylighting Mapes Creek is a great thing. But also, I would say, struggling with gentrification, by that I mean, as you know, Seattle, every time some white folks like us say, Rainier Beach is a great place to live because there's so much diversity. We all pour in here, and next thing you know, it's the next white neighborhood of Seattle. How are we going to do this in an economy that rewards money and profit? How are we going to make this a neighborhood in which we really hold on to, you know, what the NPR reported some years ago, made this zip code, 981118, the most diverse zip code in the United States, in a city that people assume is largely white because they spend all their time in the north. But really, the real Seattle is one of the experiments in which what it meant to be here will include all of our species, the economic range of our species, but also consider all that is here, people. You know, there's lots of raccoons in this neighborhood. What do we do with raccoons? How are we going to live with raccoons? You know, what treaty shall we make with raccoons and the crows?
The treaty that you made in your backyard is you feed them, right? what did I remember from that night we had dinner back there?
Yeah, they have their route. They have their route.
And you honor and respect that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always going to struggle with it, you know? I mean, I think the answers aren't clear, but we have to think deeply. And, of course, what's thriving in Seattle, it's all the recycler species. So crows and raccoons and all these things that live off the fat of a disposable society. And, yeah, they have their place. But, you know, that disposal, that creatures that thrive on the disposability culture are the ones that are ascendant. What else was lost? What else should we be worried about?
The Pacific Martin.
For example. good luck seeing one of those. You know, good luck being one of the people who will be able to say that they saw one in your lifetime.
No kidding. And I've been to the Olympics 30, 35 times. Yeah. And backpacking many of those times. In the book, Mountains and Rivers, Snyder writes about ghost bison, ghost bears, ghost bighorn, etc. And he concludes with, then the white man will be gone.
Yes.
So, and he's a white man speaking in this way.
Absolutely.
And he's not speaking of skin necessarily, but he's speaking of a way of being on this planet. He's speaking of a cultural whiteness. Yes. Can you elaborate on that?
I think that's an extremely powerful passage in Snyder. I think it resonates so deeply with other thinkers also. On the one hand, he's evoking the ghost dance. And as people probably know, the ghost dance was received by Wovoka, who thought if this dance could be done, all the indigenous people who had died and been destroyed would come back. And the ghost dance led to the horrible tragedy at Wounded Knee that was crushing the ghost dance. Ghost dance, we thought they had exterminated it. A new work just came out that said, no, it still survived. So deep was this hope. But Snyder reads this extraordinary hope among indigenous peoples that the white man would go away and that the dead would come back. He reads it, the dead, as all indigenous peoples, so that includes all the species that have gone extinct in this country. It includes all the wounded and vanishing species in this country, which is a lot of them. All the wounded and vanishing ecosystems. That were we to do this dance, were we to sing this poetry that brings together philosophy and science and ethics and deep practice, were we to do this dance, and were all of us to do this dance, the dead would come back, as in a very different world would again show itself. Because what would go away, again, this on the one hand, is literally taking it from the vision that Wovoka had, the white man would go away. Now, the white man has nothing to do with something that is true intrinsically about Caucasian pigment. The fact of whiteness, as a scientific fact, tells you almost nothing about a person. It's like saying, you know, what does the fact that you're tall tell you about a person or your shoe size? So the fact of whiteness is very different from the idea of whiteness. You know, Charles Mills, who I don't discuss in the book, but I could well have, I wanted to write a very long book, spoke about this as the racial contract. You know, what shall matter is not the fact of whiteness, but the idea of whiteness. The idea of whiteness shall now designate going forward and shall benefit all those who meet the criteria of this idea, those who matter as people. And those who don't matter as people, those who don't meet the criteria of this, are the disposable, the enslavable, the genocidable, the exploitable at work. So this immense white privilege that all white people accept as, or inherit, even if you are a counter-signatory, even if you oppose it, we still benefit from it. The white, capitalist, disproportionately male, the racial contract has interlines with gender contracts, with poverty contracts, with all these ways in which we let the white man mean not the fact of white men, but the ideology of power.
Control and domination.
Control and domination of the earth as it disproportionately rewards almost none of us, including, even in the final analysis, not all that many white men, although they still are beneficiaries to some extent. The Ghost Dance, this crazy suicidal ideology, stingy, self-serving, delusional, all the Buddhist three poisons, dissipates in an awakening. We wake up to each other meaning not just other humans, but all the life forms with whom we share our being. The earth itself in its bioregional, temporal, spatial singularity. All this emerges. The dead come back. I think it's an incredibly compelling vision. I think that Snyder's masterpiece is also a carefully designed technology of awakening. It is to kill the white man as an ideology of ultimately suicidal, but in the interim, deeply genocidal and speciesidal, if I can make that word up, you know, the rendering to extinction of non-human animals and the persecution of the majority of our species. This habitation scheme upon which the global world order has been built, what Snyder calls the New World Disorder. The New World Disorder comes to an end. Now that's a revolution, but the revolution has to happen not on television, not just in marching, not just through legislation. It has to be first and foremost a revolution of the mind. And that's hence why I want to insist that the book insists that there is, for want of a better word, an unavoidable spiritual quality to the climate emergency. If I don't know how else to name, and I'm happy to use other words, there has to be some awakening transformation about who we are, and we can mark that as the awakening of the Ghost Dance, after which the white man is dead. Thank God. Everyone should celebrate that, including those who in fact happen to be white and male, and those who are the beneficiaries, even in refusing it. They still have to say, well, okay, that means I'm going to have to sing that ghost dance twice as much as everyone else. That's okay. That's good Zen.
I'm really grateful for your time.
Thank you, Paul. It's really a great gratitude to know you, to have you as a friend, and to learn so much from you and all the extraordinary work that you do and have been doing for years. Thank you so much. What a privilege.